In the next instant, the power died. Terror gripped the Veilman. Desperately, he tried again. Nothing happened. Amberlee rushed to his side, calling frantically to him, but her words were lost in the shriek of the wind. Will staggered back, stunned. He had failed. The power of the Elfstones was no longer his to command. An instant later, Crispin was on the bridge. He never hesitated. Dropping the bow, he drew his sword and started toward the demon. The creature seemed to hesitate slightly. It had not expected a direct confrontation. Wind buffeted the catwalk, causing metal supports to creak in protest as the structure swayed unsteadily. "The pins!" Crispin called back sharply. In a daze, Will thrust the elfstones back into his tunic, retrieved his mallet, and resumed striking futilely at the frozen pin. Still, it would not move. From the shadows behind him, Amberlee darted forward. Picking up the mallet that Crispin had discarded, she began to hammer wildly at the other pin. On the catwalk, Crispin closed with the Reaper. Fainting and lunging, the captain of the Home Guard sought to catch the demon off balance, hoping that it might slip and tumble from the walk. But the Reaper stayed low upon the slender bridge, warding off the elf's thrusts with one massive arm, waiting patiently for its chance. Crispin was a skilled swordsman, yet he could not penetrate the creature's defenses. The Reaper edged forward, and the elf was forced to give ground. Rage and frustration swept through Will Ohmsford. Gripping his mallet in both hands, he pounded the rusted pin with every ounce of strength left in him, and at last the pin flew from its seating into the chasm. But as it did, the bridge buckled slightly and Crispin was thrown off balance. As he stumbled back, the Reaper lunged. Claws fastened about the elf's tunic. As Will and Amberlee watched in horror, the Reaper lifted Crispin clear of the catwalk. The elf captain's sword flashed downward toward the demon's throat, the blade splintering as it struck. The Reaper shrugged off the blow as if it were nothing. Holding Crispin above its shrouded head, it threw the elf from the catwalk into the void beyond. Crispin fell soundlessly and was gone. Again, the Reaper started forward. Then a sudden burst of wind caught the already weakened catwalk with a powerful thrust that snapped the final pin in its seating. Separating from the platform, the narrow span fell away from the cliff face, carrying with it the clinging form of the Reaper. Slowly it dropped, falling with a groan of iron toward the far cliff, metal snapping, breaking, twisting. It swung through the narrow band of moonlight back into the shadows, crashing against the mountainside. Yet it did not break free entirely, but continued to hang from its ruined supports, swinging precariously with the motion of the wind. In the darkness of the cliffs, it was barely visible. The Reaper was nowhere to be seen. Amberlee's voice rose above the pitch of the wind, a thin, frightened wail calling to Will. Wind howled past the Veilman in frenzied bursts, chilling him to the bone, filling his ears with its whine. He could not understand what the girl was saying. He did not care. His fist still clutched his mallet uselessly. His mind whirled. Crispin and the elven hunters were gone. The power of the elf stones was lost. Amberlee and he were alone. She was crying into his shoulder, pleading with him to come away. He turned to her now and pulled her close against him. For an instant he seemed to hear Al-Anon's voice telling him that it was he most of all whom the druid would depend upon. He stood at the edge of the chasm a moment longer, holding the elven girl, staring helplessly into the blackness below. Then he turned away. With Amberlee clutched tightly against him, he disappeared into the shelter of the tower. Chapter 25. It took them the remainder of the night to find their way out again. With only the single torch that Crispin had left fastened in an iron wall bracket at the tower entry to guide them, they followed a seemingly endless succession of passages and stairways that wound steadily downward through the mountain's rock. Completely exhausted by the ordeal of the past few days, they stumbled mindlessly along the corridors of the ancient keep, eyes fixed on the blackness ahead, hands clasped. They did not speak. They had nothing to say. The shock of all that had happened had left them numb with fright. They wanted only one thing now, to escape this mountain. Their sense of time slipped quickly away from them until it no longer had meaning. It must have been minutes or hours or even days that they had been shut within the rock. They no longer knew. They had no idea where the passageways were taking them. They were trusting blindly to luck and to instinct, following the tunnels and corridors with a desperate, unvoiced insistence that somehow they would eventually break free. Muscles ached and cramped, and their vision blurred with fatigue. The single torch they carried burned down until it was little more than a stump. Still, the passageway burrowed on. But at last, it ended. A massive iron door sealed with double locks and a crossbar stood before them. Will was reaching for the locks when Amberlee seized his arm, her voice weary and strained. "Will, what if there are demons waiting for us out there as well? What if the Reaper wasn't alone?" The Veilman stared at her wordlessly. He hadn't considered that possibility until now. He hadn't allowed himself to consider it. He thought back to all that had befallen them since Dre Wood. Always the demons seemed to find them. There was a sense of inevitability about it. Even if the Reaper were finally gone, there were other demons. And the spy at Arbalon had heard everything. "Will?" Amberlee's face was anxious as she waited for him to respond. He made his decision. "We have to chance it. There is nowhere else for us to go." Gently he removed her hand from his arm and positioned her behind him. Then cautiously he released the locks, lifted clear the crossbar, and swung open the door. Hazy daylight slipped through the opening. Beyond, the murky waters of the Myrmidon lapped softly at the walls of a deep grotto that housed the hidden docks of the elves. Nothing moved. Veilman and Elf Girl exchanged quick glances. Wordlessly, Will dropped the torch to the tunnel floor where it died. The docks and boats moored to them were rotted and useless. Veilman and Elf Girl made their way along a narrow ledge within the grotto until they had emerged onto the forested riverbank that lay at the base of the Pycon. There was no one there. They were alone. Dawn was just breaking, a chill, frosted morning half-light that had crystallized the dew of nightfall on the trees and brush and left the land white with a covering of false snow. They stared at it wonderingly, seeing their own breath cloud the air before their faces, feeling the chill seep into their damp bodies beneath the covering of their clothes. The river churned noisily between the mountain peaks, flowing eastward through the forest land, its broad surface shrouded in a heavy blanket of fog. The Pycon rose into this fog, massive, dark spires that shadowed the land. Will glanced about uncertainly. Within the darkness of the cave, the boats of the elves lay in ruins. There was nothing here that could help them. Then he caught sight of a small skiff pulled up on the riverbank and partially concealed within the brush just a dozen yards away. Taking hold of Amberlee's hand, he led the way along the heavily overgrown bank until they had reached the skiff. It was a fishing boat, in good condition, secured by lines, obviously left by someone who, from time to time, must have enjoyed the fishing close to the deep grotto waters. The Veilman released the lines, placed Amberlee within the skiff, and pushed off into the river. Their need for the boat was much greater than that of the absent fisherman. They drifted eastward with the river's flow as dawn lengthened into morning and the day began to warm. Wrapping herself in her cloak, Amberlee was asleep almost at once. Will would have slept as well had sleep been possible. But sleep would not come to him, his weariness so great that it actually inhibited sleep. His mind filled with thoughts of what had befallen them. Fitting a small oar that lay within the skiff into a stern oarlock, he propped himself at the rear of the little boat and guided it along the river's channel, watching numbly as the sun rose from behind the mountains and the haze of early morning burned away. Bit by bit the frost melted away in the forest about him. The peaks of the Picon disappeared as the river carried them on, and the damp green of the forest land rose up in their stead. The sky was free once more from rain clouds and darkness, turned a brilliant blue and laced with thin white streamers that floated lazily through the morning sunshine. Toward noon the Myrmidon began to swing back on itself, curving slowly south until at last it swung westward toward the dark line of the rock spur. The day had warmed and the dampness and chill of dawn had seeped from their bodies and clothing. Across the span of the Myrmidon flew birds in brilliant bursts of sound and color. The smell of wildflowers filled the air. Amberlee stretched and came awake, her sleepy eyes settling quickly on the veilman.
"Have you slept?" she asked drowsily.
He shook his head. "I couldn't." She pushed herself into a sitting position.
"Then sleep now. I will steer the boat while you do. You have to get some rest."
"No, it's okay. I am not tired."
"Will, you are exhausted."
There was concern in her voice.
"You have to sleep."
He stared at her wordlessly for a moment, his eyes haunted. "Do you know what happened to me back there?" he asked finally. She shook her head slowly.
"No.
And I don't think you do either." "I know, all right. I know exactly what happened. I tried to use the elf stones and could not. I no longer command their power. I have lost it."
"You don't know that. You had trouble with the stones before when you tried to use them in the Tyrfing. Perhaps this time you tried too hard. Perhaps you did not give yourself enough of a chance."
"I gave myself every chance," he declared softly. "I used everything I had within me to call up the power of the elf stones. But nothing happened. Nothing." "Alanon told me this might happen. It is because of my elf blood mixing with my human blood. Only the elf blood commands the stones, and mine is thin indeed, it seems. There is a block within me, Amberlee. I overcame it once, but I can no longer do so." She moved over to sit close to him, her hand resting lightly on his arm.
"Then we will get by without the stones."
He smiled faintly at the suggestion. "The elf stones are the only weapon we have. If the demons find us again, we are finished. We have nothing with which to protect ourselves."
"Then the demons must not find us."
"They have found us every time, Amberlee, despite every precaution we have taken. They have found us wherever we have gone. They will find us this time as well. You know that."
"I know that you are the one who insisted that we not turn back after our flight from Havenstead," she responded. "I know that you are the one who has never once suggested giving up. I know that you are the one Alanon chose as my protector. Would you desert me?"
Will flushed.
"No. Not ever. Nor I you. We began this journey together and we shall end it together. We shall depend on each other, you and I. We shall see each other through. I think maybe that will be enough."
She paused, a quick smile crossing her face.
"You realize, of course, that you should be giving this talk to me, not I to you. I was the one without faith in my heritage, without belief in the words the druid spoke. You have always believed."
"If the stones had not failed me," Will began glumly. Amberlee's hand came up quickly against his lips, silencing him.
"Do not be so certain that they have failed you. Think a moment on what you tried to do with them. You sought to use them as a weapon of destruction. Is this possible for you, Will? Remember, you are a healer. It is your code of life to preserve, not destroy. Elven magic is but an extension of the one who wields it. Perhaps you were not meant to use the elf stones in the way in which you tried to make them act when you faced the Reaper. The Veilman thought it over. Al-Anon had told him that the three stones acted to mesh heart, mind, and body into the power that formed the magic. If any one were lacking... No. He shook his head emphatically. The distinction is too finely drawn. My grandfather believed in the preservation of life as strongly as I, and yet he used the elf stones to destroy, and he did so without the difficulty that I have experienced. Well, then there is another possibility, she continued. Al-Anon warned you of the resistance caused by the mix of human blood with elven. You have experienced it once already. Perhaps this has caused you to create your own block, a block within your mind that convinces you subconsciously that the power of the elf stones is lost, when in fact it is not. Perhaps the block you experienced at the catwalk was one of your own making. Will stared at her wordlessly. Was that possible? He shook his head. I don't know. I cannot be sure. It happened so fast. Then hear me. She moved close so that her face was next to his. Do not be so quick to accept as truth what is only conjecture. You have used the elf stones once. You have called upon their power and made it your own. I do not think that such a gift is so easily lost. Perhaps it is just misplaced. Take time to look for it before you decide that it is no longer yours. He looked at her with amazement. You have more confidence in me than I do. That seems very strange. You thought me worthless on our journey north from Havenstead. You remember that? She drew back slightly. I was wrong to think that. I said things that I should not have said. I was afraid. For an instant it appeared as if she would say more, but as on the other occasions when she had seemed ready to explain her fear, she let the matter drop. Will was wise enough to do likewise. Well, you were right about one thing, he offered, trying to keep the tone of his voice light. I should be giving this talk to you, not you to me. There was a wistful look in her eyes. Then remember to do so when you see that I need it. Now will you sleep? He nodded. I think I might. For a little while, at least. He eased forward, letting the elf girl slip her arm about the small rudder. Lowering himself into the bottom of the boat, he made a pillow of his cloak and laid his head down wearily. Thoughts of the elf stones played teasingly within his mind. He closed his eyes, enfolding such thoughts in blackness. Believe in yourself, Al-Anon had told him. Did he have that belief? Was that belief enough? The thoughts scattered, drifting. He slept. He was awake by mid-afternoon. Cramped and sore, he eased himself up from the hard bottom of the skiff and moved back to take the rudder from Amberley. He was hungry and thirsty, but there was nothing to eat or drink. They had lost everything in their flight through the Picon. A short time later, the channel began to narrow, and the limbs of the trees on either bank closed above them like a canopy. Shadows lengthened across the spread of the river. In the west, the sun dropped low above the wall of the Rockspur, its golden light turning red with the coming of dusk. A stretch of rapids bounced the skiff wildly along the channel, but Will kept the little boat free of the rocks and straight on her course until they were clear. When the river again began to swing south on its long journey back toward the grasslands of Callahorn, the Veilman brought the skiff ashore and they disembarked. They spent the night at the base of a massive old willow several hundred yards back from the river's edge. Concealing the skiff in the brush beside the riverbank, they gathered fruit and vegetables for an evening meal and set out in search of drinking water. There was none to be found, however, and they were forced to make do with the food. They ate, conversed briefly, and fell asleep. Morning dawned bright and pleasant, and Veilman and Elven Girl began the hike westward to the Rockspur. They walked briskly, enjoying the warmth of the early morning, consuming as they went the remainder of the fruit they had gathered the previous evening. The hours passed quickly, and the stiffness they had experienced on first awakening disappeared as they wound their way steadily ahead. By mid-morning they had discovered a small stream where rapids emptied down into a pond, and the water was suitable for drinking. They drank their fill, but having no containers, they could take nothing with them. As the day wore on, the mountains of the Rockspur loomed closer above the wall of the forest in a massive, humped line of peaks that stretched away across the whole of the western horizon. Only to the far south, where lay the vast, impenetrable mire of the Shroud Slip, were the mountains absent, and there the skyline was filled with thick, gray mist that rose out of the swamp like heavy smoke. For the first time since they had escaped the Pycon, Will began to worry about where they were going. Their decision to follow the Myrmidon down to the forests bordering the mountains had seemed obvious enough, but now that they were there, he found himself wondering how they were ever going to manage a crossing of these monstrous peaks. Neither of them was familiar with this range. Neither knew if there were passes that would take them safely through. Without the elven hunters to guide them, how were they to keep from becoming hopelessly lost? By sunset, they were right up against the Rockspur, staring upward thousands of feet at a maze of peaks that loomed one above the next and offered no sign of passage nor hint of break. Veilman and Elven Girl climbed out of the forest until they had reached the lower slopes of the nearest mountain. Broad, grassy pastures there were covered with brilliant bluebells and red centauries. The sun was almost gone, and they looked for a campsite. They quickly found a stream that emptied down out of the rocks. At a small pool within a grove of pine, they settled in for the night. Another meal of fresh fruit and vegetables was consumed, but Will found himself hungry for meat and bread and ate what they had without much interest. A new moon and a spectacular display of stars filled the sky. Bidding each other good night, they rolled themselves into their traveling cloaks and closed their eyes. Will was still wondering how they were going to get through the mountains when sleep came to him. When he awoke, a boy was sitting there, looking at him. It was dawn, and the sun was rising out of the distant forest land in a hazy, golden burst of light that scattered night in fleeting bits of gray. On the broad, open slopes of the mountain which rose above them, the wildflowers were just opening, and the dew glistened damply on the grass. Will blinked in surprise. At first he thought that his eyes were playing tricks on him, and he waited expectantly for the boy to disappear back into his imagination. But the boy remained where he was, seated on the grass, legs crossed before him, silently contemplating Will. This was no illusion, the Veilman decided, and pushed himself up on one elbow. "Good morning," he said. "Good morning," the boy replied solemnly. Will brushed the sleep from his eyes and took a moment to study the boy. He was an elf, rather small, his tousled sand-colored hair falling down about a rather ordinary face that displayed a light sprinkling of freckles. Leather pants and tunic fitted close on his small frame, and a number of assorted pouches and bags hung about his neck and from his waist. He was very young, certainly much younger than either Will or Amberley.
"I didn't want to wake you," the boy announced.
Will nodded.
"You were very quiet." "I know. I can walk through a stretch of dry pine without making a single sound."
"You can?"
"Yes, and I can hunt to a fox lair without starting him. I did that once."
"That's very good." The boy looked at him curiously.
"What are you doing out here?"
Will grinned in spite of himself. I was just wondering the same thing about you. Do you live here?
The boy shook his head.
No, I live to the south, below the Erebus, in the Wing Hove.
Will did not have the faintest idea what a Wing Hove might be. Behind him he heard Amberley stir awake.
She is very pretty, the boy ventured quietly. Are you married?
No. Just traveling together, the veilman managed, a bit taken back.
How did you get here?
I flew, the boy answered.
I'm a wing rider.
Will stared at him speechlessly. The boy glanced past him to Amberley, who was just sitting up, still wrapped in her cloak.
Good morning, lady, he greeted.
Good morning, Amberley replied,
amusement mixed with puzzlement in her green eyes.
What is your name?
Perk.
My name is Amberley.
The elven girl smiled.
This is Will.
The boy got to his feet and came over to grip Will's hand in greeting. The veilman was surprised to find the youngster's palm heavily calloused. The boy seemed conscious of the fact and drew his hand back quickly. He did not offer it to Amberley, but simply nodded.
Would you like some breakfast? He asked.
Will shrugged. What do you have in mind, Perk?
Milk, nuts, cheese, and bread. That is all I have with me.
That will do nicely.
The veilman grinned, glancing back quickly at Amberley. He had no idea what Perk was doing here, but the food sounded delicious.
We would be very happy to share breakfast with you.
They seated themselves in a circle. From one of the pouches he carried, the young elf produced the promised nuts, cheese, and bread, together with three small cups. The cups he filled with milk he carried in a second pouch. Veilman and elven girl consumed the small meal ravenously.
Where did you get the milk? Amberley asked after a moment.
Goats, the boy mumbled, his mouth full. A goat herd keeps a small flock in a meadow several miles north. I milked one earlier this morning.
Amberley glanced questioningly at Will, who shrugged.
He tells me that he is a wing rider. He flies.
I'm not really a wing rider. Not yet, the boy interrupted. I'm too young. But one day I will be.
There was an awkward moment of silence as the three stared wordlessly at one another.
You didn't say what you were doing out here, Perk said finally. Are you running away from something?
Why do you ask that, Perk? Amberley wanted to know immediately.
Because you look like you were running away from something. Your clothes are torn and dirty. You carry no weapons and no food and no blankets. You build no fire. And you look like something has frightened you.
Perk, you are a bright boy, Will responded quickly, deciding at once how he was going to handle this.
Will you promise to keep it secret if I tell you something?
The boy nodded, anticipation showing in his face.
I promise.
Good. Will leaned forward confidentially.
This lady, Amberley, is very special. She is a princess, a granddaughter of Eventine Elicidal, the king of the elves.
King of the land elves,
Perk corrected. When Will hesitated, confused by the distinction, the boy edged forward anxiously.
Do you go in quest of treasure? Or is the lady enchanted? Is she bewitched?
Yes.
No.
The veilman stopped.
What had he gotten himself into?
We go in search of a talisman, Perk. Only the lady can wield it. There is a very great evil that threatens the elven people. Only the talisman can protect against that evil, and we must find it quickly. Would you be willing to help us?
Perk's eyes were wide with excitement.
An adventure? A real adventure?
Will, I don't know about this, Amberley interrupted, frowning.
Trust me, please.
Will held up his hands placatingly. He turned back to Perk.
This is a very dangerous business, Perk. The things that hunt us have already killed a number of elves. This will not be a game. You must do exactly as I ask, and when I tell you that it is finished, you must leave us at once.
Agreed.
The boy nodded quickly.
What do you want me to do?
The Veilman pointed toward the Rockspur.
I want you to show me a way through those mountains. Do you know one?
Of course.
Perk sounded very indignant.
Where is it that you are going?
Will hesitated. He was not certain that he wanted the boy to have that information.
Does that matter? He asked finally.
Certainly it matters, Perk replied at once. How can I show you how to get to where you want to go if I don't know where it is that you are going?
That sounds very sensible, Amberley offered, giving Will a knowing glance that suggested that he should have foreseen all this.
I think you had better tell him, Will. The Veilman nodded.
All right. We are going into the Wilderun.
The Wilderun?
Perk shook his head solemnly, some of the enthusiasm fading from his eyes.
The Wilderun is forbidden to me. It is very dangerous.
We know, Amberley agreed, but we have no choice. We have to go there. Can you help us?
I can help you, the boy declared firmly.
But you cannot go through the mountains. That would take days.
Well, if we don't go through the mountains, then how do we get there? Will demanded.
Is there another way?
Perk grinned.
Sure. We can fly.
Will looked over at Amberley for help.
Perk, we cannot really fly, she said gently.
We can fly, he insisted. I told you, I'm a wing rider.
Almost a wing rider, anyway.
Some imagination, thought Will.
Look, Perk, you have to have wings to fly, and we don't have wings.
Wings?
The boy looked confused. Then he grinned.
Oh, you thought... Oh, I see. No, no, not us. We have genuine. Here, come with me.
He rose quickly and moved out of the shelter of the pine grove. Mystified, Will and Amberley trailed after, exchanging confused glances as they went. When they were all beyond the trees and standing on the open slope, Perk reached into a leather pouch tied about his neck and produced a small silver whistle. Putting the whistle to his lips, the boy blew into it. There was no sound. Will looked at Amberley a second time and shook his head slowly. This was not working out the way he had intended it. Perk slipped the silver whistle back into its pouch and turned to scan the skyline. Mechanically, the Veilman and the elven girl looked with him. Suddenly, a great, golden-hued form soared out of the Rockspur, shimmering brightly in the warm morning sunlight as it dipped downward through the mountains and came toward them. Will and Amberley started wildly. It was the biggest bird they had ever seen in their lives, a huge creature with a wingspan of fully 30 feet, a sleek, crested head the color of fire tinged with flecks of black, a great hooked beak, and powerful talons that extended forward as it approached. For just an instant, both were reminded of the winged black thing that had very nearly caught them in their flight through the Valley of Wren, but then they realized that this was not the same creature. It dropped to the meadow not a dozen feet in front of them, wings folding close against its golden feathered body, crested head arching upward as it came to roost. Its piercing cry split the morning stillness, and it dipped its head sharply toward Perk. The boy gave a quick, odd call in reply, then turned again to his astonished companions.
"This is genuine," he announced brightly.
Then he grinned.
"You see? I told you we could fly."
Seeing genuine made Will and Amberley more willing to accept the story that Perk then proceeded to tell them. Before the time of Jarl Shannara and the advent of the Second War of the Races, a small community of elves migrated south from their traditional homeland, for reasons which had long since been forgotten, to settle below the Erebus along a rugged, uncharted stretch of mountainous forest land that bordered a vast body of water known to the races as the Blue Divide. These elves were Perk's ancestors. Over the years they became hunters and fishermen, their small villages built back upon a string of shoreline cliffs that abutted the Blue Divide west of the Mirian. The elves quickly discovered that they were sharing the cliffs with a rookery of massive hunting birds that nested within caves opening out over the waters of the Divide. They called the birds rocks, after a legendary bird from the Old World. The rocks and the elves kept a respectable distance from one another at first, but in time it became apparent to the elves that the giant birds would be useful to them if they could be trained to serve as carriers. The elves were resourceful and determined, and they set out to accomplish this end. After numerous failures, they managed to discover a means of communication with the birds, which in turn led to harnessing several of the young, and finally, to mastery of the entire rookery. The birds became carriers of the elves, who were now able to expand their hunting and fishing grounds. The birds became protectors as well, trained to do battle against the enemies of the community. The elves, in their turn, kept the rocks safe from creatures that sought to invade their rookery or to encroach upon their feeding grounds. They learned to care for the great birds, to treat them for sickness and injury, to heal them, and to keep them well. With the passage of the years, the bond between the two grew stronger. The community they shared, they called the Winghove. It was small and isolated in a wilderness only sparsely settled by men and rarely traveled. All contact between the Winghove and the larger elven communities that lay north of the Wilderun had long since ceased. The elves in the Winghove had formed their own government, and although they recognized the sovereignty of the elven kings at Arbarlon over the majority of the Westland elves, they considered themselves a separate people. Thus they came to refer to themselves as Sky Elves, and to the rest of the Westland elves as Land Elves. Perk was the son and grandson of Wing Riders. Wing Riders were the men who trained and rode the giant rocks, the men who directed the search for food and the defense of the Winghove. There were other designations given to the men and women of the Winghove, but Wing Rider was the most coveted. Only the Wing Rider was given command over the rock. Only he was given the power of flight, to ride the sky lanes from one corner of the land to the other. The Wing Rider was a man who commanded the honor and trust of his people, who would spend his life in their service, and who would be recognized forever as a symbol of their way of life. Perk was in the second year of his training to become a Wing Rider. The choice of one who would become a Wing Rider was made at an early age, and the training then continued until the boy reached manhood. Often the choice was virtually predetermined, as in the case of Perk, where both his father and his grandfather were Wing Riders, and it was expected that he should follow in their footsteps. Genuine was his grandfather's mount, but his grandfather was too old to fly in regular service for the Winghove. When Perk reached manhood, Genuine would become his. The rocks lived to be very old, their lives spanning 4 and sometimes 5 elven generations. Thus, a rock would serve several masters during its lifetime. Genuin had seen service first as the carrier of Perk's grandfather, but if her health remained good, she would one day serve Perk's son or grandson as well. For the moment, however, she served Perk as he trained under the supervision of his grandfather to become a Wing Rider. It was a training exercise that had brought the elven boy into the Rockspur and to his meeting with Will and Amberley. His development as a Wing Rider required that he make longer and longer flights from the Winghove. For each flight, he was given certain tasks to accomplish and rules to follow. On this particular outing, he was required to stay away from the Winghove for a period of 7 days, carrying with him only a small ration of bread and cheese and a container of water. He was to find additional food and drink on his own. He was to explore and be able to describe accurately on his return certain portions of the mountainous country surrounding the Wilderun. The Wilderun itself was forbidden to him, as it was to all who were still in training. He might set down upon the land that bounded the Wilderun, but not within. He was to avoid all contact with its denizens. The instructions seemed explicit enough, and Perk did not question them. But then on the morning of his second day out, while flying south along the eastern edge of the Roxburgh, he caught sight of Will and Amberley, two bundled forms asleep in a pine grove below him. After winging downward for a closer look, he found himself faced with an immediate dilemma. Who were these travelers, elves like himself, a young man and a younger girl, clearly from another part of the land? What were they doing in this rugged country, so poorly equipped? A moment's thought was all that it took, and the decision was made. He had been ordered to avoid any contact with the denizens of the Wilderun, but no directions had been given him regarding his contact with anyone else. An oversight on the part of his grandfather, perhaps, but a fact nevertheless. Despite the maturity and caution instilled in Perk by the intense demands of his training, he was still a boy with a boy's spirit of adventure. His grandfather had left the door cracked before him, and it was natural enough that he should want to push it open the rest of the way. After all, although he was an obedient boy, he was also a curious one. Sometimes the former must be permitted to give way to the latter. Fortunately for Will and Amberley, this proved to be one such time. Perk finished his story, then patiently answered questions for a moment or two. But his eagerness to begin his new adventure finally got the better of him. With an unmistakable look of anticipation, he asked his new companions if they were ready yet to depart. Jenowyn, although not used to carrying more than one rider, could easily do so. She would have them across the mountains of the Roxburgh before they knew it. Will and Amberley looked doubtfully at the giant bird. Had there been another way, they would have taken it gladly. Even the thought of flying made their stomachs feel queasy. But there was no alternative, and there the boy stood, hands on hips, waiting for matters to get underway. With a shrug of his shoulders to Amberley, Will announced that they were ready. After all, if a mere boy could do this, certainly they could also. With Perk in the lead, they moved over to Jenowyn. The giant bird was equipped with a leather harness that was bound tightly about her body. Perk showed them foot loops that would allow them to climb the harness to the center of the rock's feathered back. He held Jenowyn steady while they did so, then fitted their boots to toe straps, directed their hands to knotted grips, and, as an added precaution, bound them to the harness with safety lines. That way, he informed them, if the wind should blow them loose, they still would not fall. Such assurances gave small comfort to the Veilman and the elven girl, who were scared enough as it was. Perk then gave each a small section of a brownish root, which he told them to chew and swallow. This root, he explained, would ease the discomfort of flying. They ate it hurriedly. When both were secure, the elven boy removed a long, leather-bound crop from beneath the harness straps and slapped Jenowyn smartly. With a piercing cry, the roc spread her great wings and rose sharply into the morning air. Petrified, Will and Amberley watched the ground drop away beneath them. The trees of the pine grove shrank as Jenowyn circled high above the meadowland, catching the wind currents and arcing swiftly west toward the peaks of the mountain range. For the Veilman and the elven girl, the sensation was indescribable. At first there was a feeling somewhere between sickness and exhilaration, and only the juice of the strange root kept their stomachs from turning over entirely. Then the sickness lessened, and the feeling of exhilaration began to heighten, sweeping through them as they watched the horizons of the land below broaden and stretch wide, a spectacular panorama of forest land, swamp, mountains, and rivers. It was an incredible sight. Before them the black peaks of the rock spur rose up like jagged teeth out of the earth, and the thin blue ribbon of the Myrmidon wound its way down out of the rock. To the north was the dark smudge of the matted brakes, set deep within the green of the Westland forests. To the east, and now far distant, lay the twin towers of the Picon. To the south, the haze of the shroud slips settled against the threshold of the Erebus. It was all there, the whole of the land, spread out below them as if contained in some hidden valley, upon whose crest they stood, all sharply revealed by a rising morning sun that burned down out of a cloudless, brilliant blue sky. Genuine rose to a height of several hundred feet, winging her way steadily into the Rockspur, weaving through its maze of peaks, slipping deftly through breaks and splits, dipping downward into valleys, then rising again to clear each new ridgeline. Will and Amberley clung to the harness with grips of iron, yet the ride was smooth. The great bird responded to the motions of the small boy who guided her, his hands and legs nudging and coaxing with a series of movements familiar to the rock. The wind whipped across them in short bursts, yet was light and warm on this summer's day, blowing softly out of the south. Perk glanced quickly over his shoulder at his new companions, a fierce grin splitting his freckled face. The smiles they returned were less than enthusiastic. They flew on for nearly an hour, winging deep within the mountains until the forest land had disappeared from view entirely. From time to time they could see the haze of the shroud slip appear through breaks in the peaks to the south, gray and friendless. Then even that was gone. The mountains closed in about them, massive towers of rock that rose up across the sunlight and left them in shadow. Will found himself thinking momentarily of what it would have been like for Amberley and him had they attempted to cross this forbidding range afoot. It was unlikely that they could have done it, particularly without the aid of the slain elven hunters. He wondered if demons still tracked them. Undoubtedly they did, he decided, but he took some small measure of satisfaction in the knowledge that even the Reaper, had it managed somehow to survive the collapse of the catwalk in the Picon, would find it impossible to follow their trail this time. A short while later, Perk guided Genuine down to a high, treeless bluff covered with long grass and wildflowers, which overlooked a mountain lake. The rocks settled smoothly back upon the earth and her riders disembarked, Perk springing nimbly from the giant bird's back, Will and Amberley stiff and awkward in their movements, their faces filled with relief. They rested on the bluff for half an hour, then climbed back upon Genuine and were off once again, winging westward through the massive peaks. Twice more during the morning they landed, resting themselves and Genuine, and then continued on. Each time Perk offered to share food and drink with his companions, and each time they quickly declined. All they would agree to accept was another piece of the strange route. Perk offered it to them without comment. It had been like this for him, too, when he had first flown. By late morning they had reached the eastern edge of the Wilderun. From atop Genuine they could see the whole of the valley clearly, a tangled mass of forest ringed by the mountains of the Rockspur and Erebus and the broad, misty sweep of the Shroud Slip. It was a forbidding stretch of woodland, heavily overgrown, a jumble of depressions and ridges, spotted with bogs and a scattering of solitary peaks that broke out of the trees like grasping arms. There was no sign of habitation, no villages nor isolated dwellings, no planted fields nor grazing stock. The whole of the valley was wilderness, dark and friendless. Will and Amberley stared down into it apprehensively. Moments later, Perk guided Genuine back into the shadow of the mountains, and the Wilderun disappeared behind the peaks. They flew on without stopping until shortly after midday, when Perk turned Genuine south again. In a slow, gradual arc, the rock slipped through a narrow break in the peaks. Ahead of them, the Wilderun again came into view. They flew toward it, dropping along a rugged slide that fell away at its lower end into the bowl of the valley. At the edge of the slide, Genuine banked right, winging downward toward a broad slope that sat back against the base of the peak and overlooked the Wilderun. Scattered clumps of trees dotted the slope, and Perk brought Genuine to rest behind a covering of fir. Will and Amberlee climbed gingerly from the rock's back, rubbing muscles that had grown stiff and cramped with the long ride. After a quick command to Genuine, Perk followed them down, his face flushed and excited.
"You see, we did it!"
He was grinning from ear to ear.
"We did indeed," Will smiled ruefully, massaging his backside.
"What do we do next?"
the boy wanted to know immediately. Will straightened himself, grimacing.
"You don't do anything, Perk. This is as far as you go."
"But I want to help," Perk insisted.
Amberlee stepped forward and put her arm about the boy. "You did help, Perk. We would not have gotten this far without you."
"But I want to go."
"No, Perk," Amberlee interrupted quickly.
"What we must do now is far too dangerous for you to become involved in. Will and I must go down into the Wilderun. You have said yourself that the Wilderun is forbidden to you, so you must leave us now. Remember, you promised Will that you would do so when we asked."
The boy nodded glumly.
"I am not afraid," he muttered.
"I know,"
the elven girl smiled.
"I don't think much of anything would frighten you."
Perk brightened a bit with this compliment, a quick smile lighting his face.
"There is one thing more you can do for us."
Will put a hand on his shoulder.
"We don't know very much about the Wilderun. Can you tell us anything about what we might find down there?"
"Monsters,"
the boy answered without hesitation.
"Monsters?"
"All kinds. Witches, too, my grandfather says."
The Veilman could not decide whether to believe that or not. After all, the grandfather was trying to keep the boy out of the Wilderun, and that was the kind of warning one would expect him to give.
"Have you ever heard of a place called Safehold?" he asked impulsively.
Perk shook his head no.
"I didn't think so."
Will sighed.
"Monsters and witches, huh?
Are there any roads?"
The boy nodded. "I will show you."
He led them out of the fir trees to a small rise where they could look down upon the valley.
"See that?" he asked, indicating a mass of fallen trees at the base of the slope.
Will and Amberlee peered downward until they saw where he was pointing.
"There is a road beyond those trees that leads to the village of Grimpen Ward. All roads in the Wilderun lead to Grimpen Ward. You cannot see anything of it from here, but it's down there, several miles into the forest. My grandfather tells me that it is a bad place, that the people are thieves and cutthroats. Maybe, though, you could find someone there to guide you."
"Maybe we can." Will smiled his thanks. At least the thieves and cutthroats were preferable to the monsters and witches, he thought to himself. Still, it wouldn't hurt to be careful. Even if all the thieves and cutthroats and witches and monsters were imaginary, there were demons searching for them, perhaps even waiting for them, who were not. Perk was deep in thought. After a moment, he looked up.
"What will you do when you find this safe hold?" he asked.
Will hesitated. "Well, Perk, when we find safe hold, we find the talisman I told you about.
Then we can return to Arbalon."
The boy's face lighted.
"Then there is something more that I can do," he announced eagerly.
He reached into the small pouch that hung about his neck and withdrew the silver whistle, handing it to the Veilman.
"Perk, what—"
Will began as the whistle was thrust into his palm.
"I have 5 days more before I must return to the Winghove," the boy interrupted quickly. "Each day I will fly once across the valley at noon. If you need me, signal with that whistle and I will come. The sound cannot be heard by humans, only by the rocks. If you can find the talisman within the 5 days that I have left, then Genuine and I will carry you north again to your homeland."
"Perk, I don't think so," Amberlee started to object, shaking her head slowly.
"Wait a minute," Will interjected. "If Genuine could fly us north again, we would save days. We would avoid all of the country we had to travel through to get here. Amberlee, we have to get back as quickly as we can. You know that."
He turned quickly to Perk. Could Genuine make such a trip? Could you?
The boy nodded confidently.
But he has said already that the Wilderun is forbidden to him, Amberlee pointed out. How can he land within it, then?
Perk thought it out.
Well, if I set Genuine down just long enough to pick you up, that would only take a moment.
I do not like this idea one bit, Amberlee declared, frowning at Will. It is entirely too dangerous for Perk, and it is a violation of the trust that he has been given.
I want to help, the boy insisted. Besides, you told me how important this was.
He sounded so determined that for a moment Amberlee could not think of a further argument. Will took this opportunity to step in again.
Look, why don't we compromise?
I'll make a promise. If there is any danger to Perk, I'll not summon him under any circumstances.
Fair enough.
But Will, the boy began. And Perk will agree that at the end of 5 days he will return to the Winghove, as he has promised his grandfather, whether or not I have summoned him, the Veilman finished, cutting short the objections Perk was about to raise.
Amberlee thought it over for a moment, then nodded reluctantly.
All right. But I will hold you to your promise, Will.
The Veilman's eyes met hers.
Then it is agreed.
He turned back to the boy.
We have to be going now, Perk. We owe you a lot.
He took the elf's rough hand and gripped it firmly in his own.
Goodbye, Amberlee said, bending down to kiss him lightly on the cheek.
Perk flushed, his eyes lowering.
Goodbye, Amberlee. Good luck.
With a final wave of farewell, the Veilman and the elven girl turned and started down the long slope toward the forest wilderness. Perk watched them until they were out of sight.
Chapter 26. In the late afternoon hours of the second day following the departure of Will and Amberlee with the elven hunters who served as their escort from the city of Arbalon, Eventide Elicidal sat alone in the study of his home, maps and charts spread out on the work table in front of him, his head bent close in concentration. Outside, the rain continued to fall in steady gray sheets, just as it had fallen for 2 days past, drenching the whole of the elven forests. Already dusk was beginning to creep forth, its shadow falling long and dark through the curtained, floor-length windows at the far side of the room. Manx lay curled at his master's feet, grizzled head resting comfortably on his forepaws, his breathing deep and even. The old king lifted his head from his work, rubbing his eyes reddened with fatigue. He stared across the room absently, then pushed his chair back from the table. Alanon should have been here by now, he thought anxiously. There was still much to be done, much that could not be done without the aid of the druid. Eventide had no idea where the big man had gone this time. He had departed early that morning and had not been seen since. The king stared out into the rain. For 3 days now he had worked with the druid and the members of his council preparing the defense for the elven homeland, a defense that he knew would be necessary. Time was slipping away from him. The Elkris continued to fail, the forbidding to weaken. With the passage of each day, the king expected to learn that both had crumbled, that the imprisoned demons had broken free, and that the invasion of the Westland had begun. The elven army was mobilized and stood ready. Pikemen, swordsmen, archers and lancers, foot soldiers and cavalry, home guard and black watch, regular army and reserve, elven fighting men from one end of the land to the other. The call had gone out, and all who were able had come to serve, leaving homes and families and pouring into the city to be outfitted with arms and equipment. Yet the king knew that even the iron will of the elven army would not be enough to withstand an assault of the entire demon horde, once it had broken free and welded itself into a cohesive unit. He knew this because Alanon had said that it would be so, and Eventide knew better than to question the druid when he made a pronouncement as dire as this one. The demons were physically stronger than the elves. Their numbers were greater.
They were savage, maddened creatures driven by a hatred that had begun with the day of their banishment from the earth and had focused in whole upon the people responsible for that banishment. For centuries there had been nothing else. Now that hatred would be given vent. Eventine harbored no illusions. If the elves did not receive help from some quarter, the demons would destroy them all. It was no good depending solely on Amberley and the seed of the Elkris. However painful the thought, Eventine knew he must accept the fact that he might never see his granddaughter again. Even before her return to Arbalon, the king had dispatched messengers to the other races, requesting that they stand with the elves against this evil that threatened his land, an evil that would ultimately consume them all. The messengers had been gone more than a week. As yet, none had returned. It was still too early, of course, to expect an answer from any of the other races, for even Callahorn was several days' ride. Even so, it was doubtful that many would come to stand with them. Certainly the dwarves would come, just as they had always come. The dwarves and the elves had stood together against every foe the free peoples of the four lands had faced since the time of the first council of the druids. Yet the dwarves must come all the way from the deep forests of the Anar, and they must come afoot, for they were not horsemen. Eventine shook his head. They would come as quickly as they could, yet perhaps not quickly enough to save the elves. There was Callahorn, of course, but not the Callahorn of old, not the Callahorn of Balinor. Had Balinor still lived, or the Buckhannas still ruled, the Border Legion would have marched at once. But Balinor was dead, the last of the Buckhannas, and Callahorn's present ruler, a distant cousin who had ascended the throne more by accident than by acclaim, was an indecisive and overly cautious man who might find it convenient to forget that the elves had come to the aid of Callahorn when last they called. In any case, the combined councils of Tirsis and Varfleet and of Kern, rebuilt since its destruction 50 years earlier, wielded more power now than the king. They would be slow to act, even if Eventine's messenger were successful in conveying the urgency of the situation, for they lacked a strong leader to unite them in their thinking. They would debate, and while they debated, the Border Legion would sit idle. Ironically, it was their mistrust of their fellow Southlanders, and more particularly their mistrust of the Federation, that would be likely to delay action on the part of the men of Callahorn. Following the destruction of the Warlock Lord and the defeat of his armies, the major cities of the deep Southland belatedly realized the extent of the threat that the Dark Lord had posed. Acting in a haste born of fear, they had formed an alliance with one another, an alliance that began as a loose-knit organization of territories, sharing common borders and common fears, and quickly grew into the highly structured Federation. The Federation was the first cohesive form of government that the race of man had known in more than 1,000 years. Its professed goal was the final unification of the Southland and the race of man under a single ruling government. That government, of course, was to be the Federation. To that end, they had begun a concerted effort to unite the remaining cities and provinces. In the 4 decades since its formation, the Federation had come to dominate almost the whole of the Southland. Of the major Southland cities, only those of Callahorn had resisted the suggested unification. The decision to do so had resulted in no small amount of friction between the two governments, especially as the Federation continued its steady advance northward toward Callahorn's borders. Eventine folded his arms across his chest, frowning. He had dispatched a messenger to the Federation, yet he had little hope that there would be help forthcoming. The Federation had shown scant interest in the affairs of the other races, and it was doubtful that they would see a demon invasion of the Westland as being of legitimate concern. In fact, it was doubtful that they would even believe that such an invasion was possible. The men of the deep Southland knew little of the sorcery that had troubled the other lands since the time of the First Council of the Druids. Theirs had been a closed, introverted existence,
and in their new expansion they had not yet encountered many of the unpleasant realities that lay beyond their own limited experience. Again, the king shook his head. No, the cities of the Federation would not come. Just as had been the case when they were warned of the coming of the Warlock Lord, they would not believe. No messenger had been sent to the gnomes. It would have been pointless to do so. The gnomes were a tribal race. They did not answer to a single ruler or governing council. Their chieftains and their seers were their leaders, and there were different chieftains and seers for each tribe, all constantly feuding with one another. Bitter and disgruntled since their defeat at Tersus, the gnomes had not mixed in the affairs of the other races in the 50 years that had since passed. It was hardly reasonable to expect that they should choose to do so now. There remained the trolls. The trolls, too, were a tribal race, yet since the conclusion of the aborted Third War of the Races, the trolls had begun unifying within the vast stretches of the Northland, tribes banding together within certain territories under council leadership. The closest and one of the largest of these communities lay within the Kershalt territory, at the northern borders of the Elven homeland. The Kershalt was occupied principally by rock trolls, though some of the lesser tribes inhabited portions of this region as well. Traditionally, elves and trolls had been enemies. In the last 2 race wars, they had fought bitterly against one another. But with the fall of the Warlock Lord, the enmity between the 2 races had lessened appreciably, and for the past 50 years they had lived in comparatively peaceful coexistence. Relations between Arbalan and the Kershalt had been particularly good. Trade had opened up and plans had been made to exchange delegations. There was a chance then that the Kershalt trolls might agree to aid them. The old king checked his thoughts and smiled wanly. A slim chance, he conceded, but he knew he could not afford to pass over any chance. The elves would have need of whomever they could find to stand with them if they were to survive. He stood up slowly, stretched, then glanced down again at the array of maps spread out on the work table. Each depicted a different sector of the Westland, chartings of all the known country that comprised the elven homeland and the territories surrounding it. Eventine had studied them until he thought it possible to trace their configurations in his sleep. Out of one of those sectors the demons would come, and there the elven defenses must be settled. But out of which? Where would the forbidding crumble first? Where would the invasion begin? The king let his eyes wander from one map to the next. Alanon had promised that he would discover where the break would come, and it was for that vital piece of information that the elven army waited. Until then, he sighed and walked to the window doors that opened onto the manor house grounds. As he stared out through the growing dusk, he caught sight of Ander coming up the walkway, head bent against the rain, arms laden with the troop registers and supply listings that he had been instructed to collect. The frown that creased the old king's face softened. Ander had been invaluable these past few days. To his younger son had fallen the tedious, if necessary, task of information gathering. Thankless work at best, and work that Arion would certainly have disdained. Yet Ander had undertaken the job without a single word of complaint. The king shook his head. Strange. But even though Arion was crown prince of the elves and the closer of his sons, there were times these past few days when he saw more of himself in Ander. He let his gaze shift then to the leaden evening skies and wondered suddenly if Ander ever felt the same. Fatigue lined Ander Elicidal's face as he pushed through the manor house doors, shed his rain-soaked cloak, and turned down the darkened hallway that led to his father's study, the troop registers and supply listings cradled protectively in his arms. His day had been a difficult one, and it had not been helped by any of his brother's continuing refusal to have anything to do with him. It had been like that since he had taken Amberley's part at the High Council.
What had always been a rather broad gulf between them had widened into a chasm that he could not begin to bridge. Today's encounter with his brother had illustrated just how wide that chasm had grown. Sent by his father to collect the information he now carried, he had gone to Arion for assistance because Arion had been given responsibility for mobilizing and outfitting the Elven army. Though Arion could have shortened his work by hours, he had refused even to meet with him, sending a junior supply officer in his stead and keeping himself conveniently absent the entire day. It had angered Anders so much that he had very nearly chosen to force a confrontation. But that might have involved his father, and the old king did not need any additional problems to occupy his time. So Anders had kept silent. For as long as the demon hordes threatened the homeland, personal difficulties must be set aside. He shook his head. Such reasoning did not make him feel any better, however, about the way things were working out between Arion and him. He reached the study door, nudged it open with his boot, entered, and nudged it closed again. He managed an encouraging smile for his father, who crossed to relieve him of the charts and listings. Then he sank down wearily into an empty chair. "That's everything," he said. "Inventoried, recorded, and placed in order." Eventine set the material his son had brought him on the table with the maps and turned back. "You look tired." Ander rose and stretched. "I am..." In a rush of wind and rain, the window doors flew open. Father and son whirled as maps and charts scattered to the floor and oil lamps flickered. Alanon stood framed in the entry, black robes glistening wetly in the dusk, trailing water onto the study floor. The angular features were strained, the thin line of his mouth hard. Both hands held firm a slim wooden staff, its surface the color of silver. For an instant Anders' eyes met those of the druid, and the elven prince felt his blood turn to ice. There was something terrible in the druid's expression, glimmerings of fierce determination, power, and death. The druid wheeled and shoved closed the window doors, fastening once again the latch he had somehow managed to loosen from without. When he turned back again, Anders saw clearly the silver staff, and his face went deathly pale. "Alanon, what have you done?" The words slipped out before he could think better of them. His father saw it as well and cried out in a horrified whisper. "The Elcris! Druid, you have cut a branch from the living tree!" "No, Eventine," the tall man replied softly. "Not cut. Not harmed her who is the life of this land. Never that." "But the staff," the king began, his hands reaching out as if to touch a thing that would burn. "Not cut," the other repeated. "Look closely now." He held forth the staff and turned it slowly so that it could be inspected. Ander and his father bent close. Each end of the staff was smooth and rounded. Nowhere was it splintered or nicked by a blade. Even the bowls that roughened its length were healed and free of markings. Eventine looked bewildered. "Then how?"
"The staff was given to me, King of the Elves. Given by her. Given that it might be carried against the enemies who threaten her people and their land." The druid's voice was so cold that it seemed to freeze the very air of the small room. "Here, then, is magic that will give strength to the elven army, power to withstand the evil that lives within the demon hordes. This staff shall be our talisman, the right hand of the Elcris, carried forth when the armies meet to do battle."
He stepped forward, the staff still clenched before him, his dark eyes hard within the shadow of his brow.
"Early this morning I went to her, alone, seeking to find a weapon with which we might stand against our enemy. She gave me audience, speaking with the images that are her words, asking why I had come. I told her that the elves had no magic save my own with which to counter the power of the demons. I told her that I feared that this alone might not be enough, that I might fail. I told her that I sought something of what she is with which to do battle against the demons, for she is an anathema to them. Then she reached down within herself and stripped away this staff which I hold, this limb of her body. Weakened, knowing that she dies, she yet managed to give to me a part of herself with which to aid the elven people. I did not touch her, did nothing but stand in awe of her strength of will. Feel this wood, King of the Elves. Touch it.
He thrust the staff into Eventine's hands, and they closed about it. The king's eyes widened in shock. The druid took the staff from him then and passed it wordlessly to Ander. The elven prince started. The wood of the staff was warm, as if the blood of life flowed within.
It lives, the druid breathed reverently. Apart and separate from her, yet still filled with her life. It is the weapon that I sought. It is the talisman that will protect the elves against the black sorcery of the demon hordes. As long as they bear the staff, the power that lives within the Elkris shall watch over them and work to keep them safe.
He took the staff from Ander's hands, and once more their eyes met. The elven prince felt something unspoken pass between them, something he could not quite comprehend. Just as it had been that night in the High Council when he had gone to stand with Amberley. The druid's eyes shifted to the king.
Now hear me. His voice was low and quick. The rains will end this night. Does the army stand ready?
Eventine nodded.
Then we march at dawn. We must move quickly now.
But where are we marching to? The king asked immediately.
Have you discovered where the break will come?
The druid's black eyes glistened.
I have. The Elkris told me. She senses the demons massing at a single point within the forbidding, senses herself weakening where they gather. She knows that it is there that the forbidding will fail first. The rent has been made once already by the ones who crossed through to slay the Chosen. The breach was closed, but the wound was not healed. There the forbidding will break. It weakens already, straining with the force that pushes against it. The demons are summoned to that place by the one who commands them, and who wields the power of sorcery so near my own. He is called the Dagda Mor. With his aid, the breach will be forced once again, and this time it will not be closed. But we will be waiting for them. His hand tightened on the staff. We will be waiting. We will catch them while they stand newly crossed and still disorganized. We will close off their passage to Arbalon for as long as we are able. We will give Amberley the time she needs to find the Bloodfire and return.
Wordlessly he beckoned Ander and his father forward. Then he reached down and pulled from the floor one of the fallen maps, setting it squarely on the work table.
The break will come here, he said softly.
His finger pointed to the broad expanse of the Hoar Flats. Chapter 27. That same afternoon, when the daylight had nearly gone and the rain had turned to fine mist, the Legion Free Corps rode into Arbalon. The people of the city who saw them pass paused in the middle of their endeavors and turned to one another with guarded whispers. From high atop the tree lanes to the forest roadways below, hushed voices spoke as one. There was no mistaking the Free Corps. Ander Elicidal was still closeted in the manor house study with his father and Alanon, kept there, oddly enough, at the druid's insistence that he familiarize himself with Westland maps of the Serendanon and proposed defensive plans,
when Gale brought word of their arrival. "My lord, a cavalry command of the Border Legion has ridden in from Callahorn," the young aide announced, appearing abruptly at the study door. "Our patrols picked them up an hour east of the city and escorted them in. They should be here in a few minutes."
"The Legion?" A broad smile spread across the old king's weary face.
"I hadn't dared to hope. What command, Gale? How many are they?"
"No word, my lord. A messenger from the patrol brought the news, but there were no details."
"No matter."
Eventine was on his feet and moving toward the door.
"Any help is welcome. Whoever. Elven King!"
Alanon's deep voice brought Anders' father about sharply.
"We have important work to do here, work that should not be interrupted. Perhaps your son might go in your place, if only to give greeting to the bordermen."
Ander stared at Alanon in surprise and turned eagerly to his father. The king hesitated, then seeing the look in his son's eyes, he nodded.
"Very well, Ander. Extend my compliments to the Legion commander and advise him that I will meet with him personally later this evening. See that quarters are provided."
Pleased with having been given a responsibility of some importance for a change, Ander hurried from the manor house, an escort of elven hunters in tow. The surprise he had experienced at Alanon's unexpected suggestion turned quickly to curiosity. It occurred to him that this was not the first time that Alanon had gone out of his way to include him when the druid need not have done so. There was that first meeting when he had told Eventine of Amberley and the Bloodfire. There was his admonition to Ander upon leaving for Perrinor to assume responsibility for his father's protection. There was that sense of alliance that had brought him to his feet in the High Council to stand with Amberley when no one else would do so. There was this afternoon's meeting when Alanon had given the Elcris staff to his father. Arion should have been present for these meetings, not he. Why was Arion never there? He had just passed through the gates fronting the manor house grounds, still pondering the matter when the foremost ranks of the border cavalry crested the roadway leading in, and the entire command wound slowly into view. Ander slowed, frowning. He recognized these riders. Long gray cloaks bordered in crimson billowed from their shoulders, and wide-brimmed hats with a single crimson feather sat cocked upon their heads. Long bows and broadswords jutted from their saddle harness, and short swords were strapped across their backs. Each rider held a lance from which fluttered a small crimson and gray pennant, and the horses wore light armor of leather with metal fastenings. Escorted by the handful of elven hunters who had picked them up while on patrol east of the city, they rode through the rain-soaked streets of Arbalon in their precise, measured lines, and glanced neither left nor right at the crowds who gathered to stare after them. "The Free Corps," Ander murmured to himself. "They have sent us the Free Corps." There were few who had not heard of the Free Corps, the most famous and the most controversial command ever attached to the Border Legion of Callahorn. It drew its name from the promise it gave to those who joined its ranks, that its soldiers might leave behind without fear of question or need for explanation all that had come before in their lives. For most, there was much to be left. They came from different lands, different histories, and different lives, but they came for similar reasons. There were thieves among them, killers and cheats, soldiers broken from other armies, men of low blood and high, men with honor and men without, some searching, some fleeing, some drifting, but all seeking to escape what they were, to forget what they had been, and to start anew. The Free Corps gave them that chance. No soldier of the Free Corps was ever asked about his past. His life began with the day he joined. What had come before was finished. Only the present mattered and what a man might make of himself for the time that he served. For most, that time was short. The Free Corps was the Legion's shock unit. As such, it was considered expendable. Its soldiers were the first into battle and the first to die. In every engagement fought since the inception of the Corps some 30 years earlier, its casualty rate had been the highest. While the past had been left behind by the soldiers of the Free Corps, the future was an even more uncertain prospect. Still, it was a fair exchange, most thought. After all, there was a price for everything, and this price was not so unreasonable. If anything, it was a source of pride for the soldiers who paid it. It gave them a sense of importance, an identity that set them apart from any other fighting man in the Four Lands. It was a tradition of the Free Corps that its soldiers should die in battle. It was not important to the men of the Corps that they should die. Death was the reality of their existence, and they viewed it as an old acquaintance with whom they had brushed shoulders on more than one occasion. No, it was not important that they should die. It was important only that they should die well. They had proven it often enough before, Ander knew. Now it appeared they had been sent to Arbalon to prove it once again. The Legion command drew to a halt before the iron gates, and a tall, gray-cloaked rider in the forefront dismounted. Catching sight of Ander, he passed the reins of his horse to another and strode forward. On reaching the elven prince and his guard, he removed the wide-brimmed hat he wore and inclined his head slightly. "I am Stijans, commander of the Legion Free Corps." For an instant, Ander did not respond, so startled was he by the other's appearance. Stijans was a big man, seeming to tower over Ander. His weathered yet still youthful face was crisscrossed with dozens of scars, some of which ran through the light red beard that shaded his jaw, leaving streaks of white. A tangle of rust-colored hair fell to his shoulders, braided and tied. Part of one ear was missing, and a single gold ring dangled from the other. Hazel eyes fixed those of the elven prince so hard that they seemed chiseled from stone. Ander found himself staring and quickly